News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving with your family. If you listened to the program last week, you heard a veteran from the California Veterans Home in Yountville. What a beautiful place that is. If you've never been there, if you're a veteran, if you can still get around and can live independently, you might want to apply to come live up here and spend the rest of your days at the California Veterans Home. It's a sprawling campus with historic trees, historic buildings, all kinds of activities for veterans. And one guy who can tell us about that is Dave Bowman, 91 years old, a pioneering naval aviator in World War II, who was actually in before the war started. And Dave, you grew up in Washington, D.C., and I'm sure that was an interesting place to be in the 1930s, in early 1940s. A lot going on in our country at that time.
Yes, strangely enough. And one thing that I took for granted, but now I'm thinking that it was unusual, we had no vote. We could not vote in the national elections. So at any one time, you never knew who was going to be a successor in the leadership of the government. So there was very little political talk as such. I enjoyed the schools there, the colleges, and I was there until I was 21 and then went in the Navy.
And the war hadn't started yet. What made you decide to join the Navy? Was it the prospect of potentially flying?
That, yes. I had started an aviation course while I was at the University of Maryland before the war. I was taking that for about a year, and I earned a commercial pilot's license, which is a little more advanced than a private pilot. So this was put on by the government in colleges all over the country, and in June 41 it finally paid off, because the Navy said, we're going to start calling these boys to active duty, giving them the opportunity. So there were about 125 of us in this course at Pensacola, and we started out at the 33-hour stage, which was acrobatic stage, and we were already qualified to do the basic stuff, which would have been three more months for the Navy. And they found out that they had some pretty good pilots. Not all of us washed out, as so often happens. Not all of them, but many. We felt that we were halfway up the ladder. We were ready to go.
Was being a pilot something you had been fascinated with since your childhood?
Didn't think so at the time, but it did preoccupy me with considerable aspirations of doing something real thrilling and unusual, and I thought very creative.
What was it that you think first got your attention about aviation? Was it the stories of Charles Lindbergh? Was it seeing the different aircraft? What do you think piqued your curiosity?
Oddly enough, I didn't read many magazines on aviation. I didn't know that much about it during my childhood, but I was always thrilled to hear a plane going over, and I'd run out of the house and, hey, take me flying. And that was my very primitive way of approaching aviation.
You've flown more than 180 aircraft in a long aviation career, and I'm sure looking back on some of the planes you've flown in more recent years, when you look back on the 1940s, you must think the planes that you were flying were pretty primitive, and it might even amaze you that you actually survived flying some of them. What was it like to fly some of those early naval planes when the Navy probably didn't even know how these planes worked?
Well, I'm thinking of one in particular that should never have left the drawing board, because it wasn't designed right. Other than that, we had some old planes. I mean, I flew planes that were in the fleet in 1928, and they were on battleships and cruisers, and this was the earliest form of flying. And I thought, if I could get onto a battleship or a cruiser, I could learn something about not aviation, but about the regular Navy, how you can live with the regular Navy. And believe me, it was a shock of my life to find out what they didn't know about aviation. And there my story begins to get thrilling.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good teaser. How did it get thrilling? And is that thrilling in a good way or thrilling in a scary, I can't believe I actually lived through that way?
You mentioned scary, yes. And this was a plane that, I was the first pilot to report for a cruiser assignment at Floyd Bennett Field in Jamaica Bay, New York, at a seaplane. Floyd Bennett had a seaplane ramp. I'd been 6 months at Pensacola as a flight instructor before that. So we're forming this aviation group. We're going to have eight pilots aboard, and we'll have about six airplanes originally assigned to us. These were folding wing airplanes that you could put down below deck on the fantail, the aft end of the ship. So we were getting ready to go either to the Mediterranean or the Pacific. At that point, I wasn't thinking about where I would be going. So I got into this airplane. There was no manual on it, and I've never seen an airplane before or since. And by the way, that's 184 models, not airplanes. I flew more than that.
Sure, 184 different types of airplanes, sure.
Okay, and so this type was a seaplane, and you could actually take the floats off it and put wheels on it, but it was designed to be put on catapults on cruisers and battleships and to replace some of these old fabric airplanes. This was all aluminum metal, and it had some, at that time, modern updates on it. It was going to be carrying depth charges. They weigh about 325 pounds each, and these were for the treatment of the submarines that we encountered, which I never saw, nor did anyone in any of my four squadrons see them. But the submarines saw us all the time. If ever you've seen a movie of a submarine in wartime, it starts out or gets involved with a scene where they're being, depth charged at depth of, say, the submarine's down at 200 or 300 feet. They're trying to get up near the surface so they can get a line on a ship and shoot the torpedoes at them. Well, the depth charge would keep them down for a while, but they'd lose track of them because our ships were moving to keep from being a steel target. And the subs would say, go to periscope depth, whether it's American or Japanese. And they'd come up to about 100 feet for the bottom of the keel to the surface of the water. The periscope would go up another 60 or 70 feet. And they could spot with their periscope and see the airplanes 40 miles away, 30 miles away, which is actually over the horizon for the ships to see. So the when they see our ships, our airplanes in the air, they would submerge and just get out of the way. So it was a passive type activity that wasn't really anticipated by the Navy, but we found out that, we were doing something worthwhile, but we didn't know what it was.
So you were sub-hunting in an aircraft without a manual, and 184 different models of airplanes that you've flown, and this is the only one that you can recall that didn't have a manual.
That's correct, and I couldn't believe it. Then they didn't seem to apologize for it. This was a Curtiss Wright manufacturing company, a very honorable and, long-time manufacturer for Navy aircraft especially. But this one, I don't know how it got arranged the way it was, because it didn't look like an airplane when as a pilot, and boy, oh boy, it didn't fly.
And he means that literally. What was the aircraft called?
Well, we call it the SO-3C, and then sometimes we ended up, after we flew it, we'd call it the Beast, because we couldn't think of anything that would be printable.
What was so bad about it? Was it just it didn't respond to what you tried to do maneuvering-wise, or what was so horrible? And you've written something about it that is entitled The Plane That Wouldn't Fly. And you mean that really literally, don't you?
Yes, I would write the same thing again. But at the time, I thought I'd really get a considerable amount of administrative guidance on how to be a naval officer. However, you'll notice on this profile, there's only one pylon between the float and the aircraft. And there's nothing else to keep the fuselage, the body, from, when you land on the water, keep it from, sinking and bending, which it did. And it would end up chopping holes in the float. The propeller would drop down. It was clearing the float by about 4 inches normally. And it would drop down about that 5 or 6 inches and chop a hole in the float that you depended on when you got on the water. And we thought, gee, that's kind of unusual. So change number 138 was, the factory said, we can fix that. So they sent us 8 little strips that they put on where the red line is, where the propeller swings by the float. And they put the, they cut a hole there, and a small watertight compartment about 6 inches deep. And you put these, when you chopped a hole in the float, you're supposed to put these little metal strips back on there. They're watertight. Meanwhile, what's going on back here? When that engine bends down, the engine mount is bending at the one single pylon that separates the float from the airplane. And then there's these things. These caused us to lose most of the 16 airplanes we crashed, the 8 of us. We killed a pilot on his first flight, but most of us flew this thing. And
you're pointing to the wingtip float, so it extends down from each wing trying to give the plane some balance as it lands on the water with the big float that's almost the length of the plane directly under the fuselage.
What would happen, you'd land into the wind, but maybe the wind had shifted, and meanwhile the water is coming in at a 30-degree angle, the wind swells, and it'll hit the side of this thing, and you're coming in at 70 knots, and at that speed, hitting that swell, it would start bending in. And you knew what was going to, and you couldn't see most of it, but you knew what was going to happen. It was going to come up. And when you came down off the, they call it the step, you were down in the water, and now this was going to be in the water. And then it wasn't going to be in the water because it had retracted up to the wing or near the wing. So sometimes you would forget, you would have a sailor in the back seat. You're giving him flight time or whatever in the shakedown time that we had, which was about 2 months. You didn't notice that he was weighing about 200 pounds. By this time, we're all wearing tennis shoes. Pilots are all wearing tennis shoes so we can run out on the wing that has the tip float left. And you don't think to tell this guy or forget about it. And he's a stranger and he's just getting his flight pay for the whatever. And so he sees this wing start to go down and he sees me running out up here and I'm yelling at him. He can't hear me. So he jumps down here and he runs out on this wing. He's going to counter my balance, my weight going out the wing. And what do you know? He goes all the way out to the tip. And what does that wing do? It doesn't do any better. It goes down in the water. And next thing you know, you're sitting on the keel upside down in the water. Of course, the plane has stopped by this time. So this is one of the many little thrills we had. And I don't want to go into too much of it, but I've got some of them in my little book here. It's a small part of what we did for the first 8 months of this cruiser that was in the South Pacific.
So you would be catapulted off the deck of the cruiser. You would fly your mission, but to land, you had to land in the water. It's not like an aircraft carrier that you can take off from, then land on and be caught by the, with the tail hook. You're landing in the water every time, and you've just described for us how difficult some of those landings could be. Was it ever a routine mission in that plane?
Holy cow, you roused my adrenaline. I don't know whether I can go on with this. Anyway, up on the front end of this was a, what they call a pawl. It was about as big around as your middle finger and about 4 or 5 inches long. And the ships were maybe 90 ships in a task force, among which were 2 carriers perhaps. But we'd be out scouting way ahead of them. But we had this little pawl on the front of the thing that when you came down, you landed in the slick of the your ship, along with maybe 5 other cruisers who were coming back from their 30-degree sector up ahead. 200 miles maybe. So you're coming in, you land on the step, you've got swells as high as, say, 20 feet more, and you had the wind chop. So you had 2 factors on the water that you had to consider and adjust for. So you're taking care of the wind chop, which is maybe 18 or 20 inches, but the wind chop could fold, collapse these wingtip floats if they hit on the side. The main fuselage would land on the swells, and you go down in the swell, and you would go into the middle of the next swell by the time you slowed down a little bit. And we used to wear silk scarves around our necks, not to be copying the Hollywood versions of a pilot, but to keep the water from running down into our body. Like if you're taking off on water, and I'm bouncing all over the place here. I'm looking at this airplane while I'm doing it. Believe me, it's distracting. So you get wet and you have to fly formation 3 hours with the pilots if you're training with them. And that was very uncomfortable. Meanwhile, you're coming in and you land on the water behind the ship and you come up onto what is we call it a sled. And it was about 3-4 feet wide and it had a prow on it and a little plate of metal across there. And then it had a cargo net behind it, what looked like a cargo net, about 8-inch squares of mesh from the ropes. And you come up on that sled, drop the power, and the ship is now pulling the plane. And they got a big crane over there with about 6 men up there to be part of the recovery crew. And your radioman gets out, jumps on the wing, and this was before we had hard hats. You jump on the wing, come up, and right here behind this hatch, behind the pilot, would be a sling about 3 feet long with a loop in it. And he would be getting that out, and then he would literally sit on top of the pilot's head. And the pilot would keep his seatbelt in to keep the radioman in, because you're holding his legs. And sometimes you'd have your goggles up on top of your head that you momentarily put up there and forgot about it. And he comes up and sits on those goggles and, yikes, where are the hard hats? They aren't here yet. So he's dodging that. The ship is bouncing and doing, you know, rolling and pitching. And we're doing the same thing. And the cable is going up and down with a 250-pound weight on it. He's trying to avoid that thing from killing him. And he's trying to grab a pendant from it about 5 feet with about a hook on it. And he reaches for that. And he gets to the hook. And everything's moving around. And now he's trying to put the harness of the airplane into the hook. It snaps, and then finally they pull you up and put you onto a V-shaped little cradle on top of a 60-foot catapult. And that catapult is, I'm looking at this room in the distance here, about 60 feet. And you have 60 knots in 60 feet when you're taking off. And I have only one comment about taking off, and that is you have to put your head against the pad at the back, like the carrier pilots do with their jets now. And you run the engine up once to check it, and then you run it up a second time and say, okay, I'm ready, and then you run it up a second time. Now, the guy that shoots the catapult is giving a signal to a guy on the end of the catapult who fires the catapult. And the firing was from a shell from one of our 6-inch cannon, 14 of them on the ship. 6 inches, about big around, that big around, and about 4 feet tall. And that's what's kicking you in the butt to get you encouraged to fly the thing on down, that whatever. The ship is rolling like this, left and right mostly. You don't mind the pitching. But the Admiral's flagship for the 6 cruisers in the task force hoists one of the signal flags saying the task force is ready for the launch of your 6 aircraft on the different cruisers. So our ship gets that message. And when they're ready, they better be ready right away. So they're ready, and they wave a big green flag from the bridge. This lieutenant that's in charge of the number 4 turret on the aft end of the ship, back end of the ship, he couldn't care less about the pilot. I'm there looking at him, you know, and if I had a problem with the engine, I didn't dare pull it back because he might be ready to shoot. So we had very poor communication, and so much, we had radio silence too. And we couldn't talk to anybody. And much less talk to this guy when I'm sitting down with him for dinner at the, you know, in the mess hall. So he's not paying any attention to the airplane. And all he wants to see is that green flag and comply with what the captain wants. And he's going to point to the gunner and shoot. Well, the plane happens to be on a pitch. I mean, on a roll to the left. And when it does, that thing goes down and you're looking at green water up to a 30 degree above where the horizon should be or whatever. And you just hope to hell you're not going to go in the water. So that has happened a few times, but fortunately it didn't happen to me. So there are many things that I can reminisce about and some things I'd like to forget about.
Well, I think our audience will agree we need to keep exploring both of those fronts after this break. We'll learn more about the plane that wouldn't fly. And if you want to see what this ill-fated aircraft looked like, check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook or on KMJNow.com. We'll be right back with 91-year-old Dave Bowman. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Another visit at the beautiful California Veterans Home in Yountville, this time with 91-year-old Dave Bowman. And Dave, I've interviewed a lot of pilots over the years, heard about a lot of airplanes, but never this SO3C, or the plane that wouldn't fly, as you've called it in your memoirs. Before the break, you were talking about being catapulted off a cruiser by the firing of a gun, and how at the mercy of the guy firing that gun you were. Easy to laugh about it now, but not so much back then.
And why do I get the picture that you must have felt kind of like some kind of circus act or human cannonball, completely at the mercy of somebody else firing that gun to send you skyward?
I felt like an orphan, and so did the rest of us. And now we're down to 6 pilots. We finally ended up, after I was 8 months on the ship, they needed to form a new squadron, and they recruited me. Well, they just said, you 3 pilots will join General Halsey, Admiral Halsey, at New Caledonia, which is 300 miles east of Australia. That was a backup base for Pacific action. And Admiral Halsey was an aviator, and he was very helpful for us in scrounging file cabinets and whatever. And we were making midnight requisitions from things that we knew were difficult to get, and he needed them more than we did. Well, we thought we needed them more than he did. So on the night before we left to load the cargo ship, we acquired many, many things, including 4 airplanes that we couldn't get otherwise. We had to bring our own airplanes up to this atoll we were going to live on for the next year. That was another book that I haven't written yet. We got to Halsey's headquarters after about 3 weeks underway in the Pacific. He heard about this airplane. He was reading dispatches on it. It's going to be the first radar supplied in 1942, first aircraft supplied with radar in the Pacific. Of course, we didn't know how to work the thing, and our radio had not been to school yet because we didn't even have a manual of how to run the airplane by this time. So that's some basic stuff, you know. And also, let me back up a bit on that. We had a civilian technician from RCA on board for 6 weeks working with our cruiser. Now we're getting ready to go, and they're going to be used for fire control directing. He's going to be able to tell us where our salvos go when we can't see the ship we're looking at. But we are the spotters. We're the observation to do that. We're supposed to be about 1,500 feet above the target, whether it's an island or a ship. And very often at 15 miles, it's over the horizon, out of sight of the ship. So radar is going to be able to tell us where these projectiles go and whatever, and I don't know that much about radar. So we had this civilian. The guy he was training, the JG junior grade officer who was not too long ago, he was at the Naval Academy, and I don't think he learned much about aviation, and I'm not too sure what he learned about gunnery, because he didn't seem to understand how to train his crew, and he didn't want that guy to leave, that radar specialist. So he talked to the captain of our ship, and he said, hey, look, I'm a bachelor, and I need some adventure, and I've got a kind of a dull job. I'll stay on board. So we shanghaied him, took him with us, and Halsey heard about that, and he said, get rid of him on the first available flight back to the States. Now we're without a specialist. We don't know how to work the radar. I'm talking about the ship's radar. Airplane never had it, but it was engineered for it. So he got rid of these two of the airplanes that we had left. One of them was aboard a Navy seaplane tender for the large PBYs, and it was at his headquarters, and they had it on a cradle, and they had the engine running up and all this noise going on, and a sailor's walking along the deck, and the prop arc is just about the height of a sailor's head, and it chopped his head off. That was going to the junk pile anyway. So another one was being towed on a trailer, a dolly, on one of the islands. They were taking it up a hill, and they had a guy up on top that had about a 15-foot bamboo pole with a yoke on the front of it, and he's hitting electric wires with that pole and picking it up and walking it past as they slowly pull the trailer with the airplane on it. And about the third time he had to do that, one of the wires fell down on him and electrocuted him. So that was the destiny of those airplanes, and the U.S. ended up, they stopped production on them, ended up sending them to Britain, and then later the Russians. And this thing had a pretty good autopilot in it. Both the British and the Russians jollied these things up with some radio controls to make drones out of them. And they ended up flying them with nobody in them and shooting them down with any aircraft. And that was a merciful action, because think of the pilots it could have killed. I mean, I could have been one of them.
Well, and I get the sense that you're pretty amazed you weren't one of them. How many missions did you fly in that? It's the SO-3C, right?
In the SO-3C, I never counted it because I wasn't proud to brag about it, and, you know, drinking beer and whatever. I guess I had more time than, well, I was the first pilot there, and I was flying 10 or 15 hours before the rest of the pilots arrived. So I think I had a little bit more time than the rest of them, and it might have been 70, 80 hours, I don't know. But I wasn't eager to get into it. But anyway, so we got rid of these things. And what do we do for airplanes? Well, there was a classmate of mine on the cruiser Minneapolis. Minneapolis had been in one of the several Savo Island battles near Guadalcanal. And these are night battles, and their cruiser had space blown off from here to the door about 60 feet from the bow all the way back to the first turret. When I saw the Minneapolis, they had put metal plates, welded metal plates across it for watertight integrity. Then there were coconut logs that were about a foot in diameter across there to keep the thing from collapsing at sea when they try to drive it back to the United States. Anyway, they had four old fabric biplanes they quit making in 1936. And they were very seaworthy. They were made by this same manufacturer, by the way, but probably a different set of engineers. Curtis made that airplane, and that would take care of it. It'll outdo the twin-engine airplanes in the ocean. Very simply, out on this wingtip, that one strut we had, while it looked aesthetic, it had no way to keep from swaying. Well, all the old airplanes made back in the 20s on up had piano wires coming back, you know, to the wing at an angle that would take side loads. Simple as that. course, the fuselage had several things separating the body of the airplane from the floats. So you could, that's why I say you can look at it as a pilot and you say, there's something wrong. Something's going to bend. For the water we have to go into, you had to take off on the water with, you've heard of coordinated operating of flying with the feet on the rudder and the stick going with it. Because of the torque of that engine, it was a over-torqued engine, you know, an overloaded engine that was not designed for this job. You'd have to have both feet on the right rudder because of the counter force of the torque taking you to the left, the left-hand circle. No way you can get off. So anyway, here was this nice old fabric biplanes, very slow. I think it flew about 100 knots at most. But the idea was that you stay out of the way of the fighters and go down and get the subs and do the scouting up ahead. We had those, and we got four of them. We were down to three of them in a hurry because we were anchoring them. I didn't have room, didn't have the dollies ready to accommodate them on the ship. So we were having it done in a harbor, rear harbor, from the Minneapolis, and we had one of them tied to a buoy. It didn't have a nightlight on it. And one of these big landing barges came by at night and plowed right over the thing. So that's how we lost that one very rare airplane. And all these airplanes were called survey damage, which meant they were going to get rid of them the first chance they had because the rusted fuselages were, you know, metal parts and so forth. And we didn't know when that engine was going to fall off either. That was a thrill. And it wasn't designed to carry depth charges, but we arranged to do that somehow. But shall I go into that?
Sure. So you've gotten rid of these airplanes that wouldn't fly, and I know you weren't sorry to see them go. But now you're continuing to hunt for subs in the Pacific on these old fabric airplanes with very little armaments, I'm sure.
Yes. So we had no autopilot, and you'd fly 3 hours holding the control stick over to one side against the left knee. Say you're holding the right wing up, you're holding it against the left knee, and you get tired of doing that. And you're looking into the blazing sun, and oh, man, and you lost your sunglasses when you stuck your head out in the prop wash a long time ago. So, and you can't get any more on your ship anymore. So we're trying to keep that wing up the whole time you're flying. Well, about the third flight I had doing that, I found a couple of rubber bands, different size. I put them on my wrist, and I went out there, stuck the thing around the stick underneath the, you know, the instrument panel, and pulled that rubber band over to the mixture control over on the side of the airplane. And the second one worked out just right to counterweight, put enough force on the side of the stick to counterweight that thing on the right wing, that bomb on the right wing. So I could sit there like a airline pilot, you know, and sit there and just write down things on my chart and do all kinds of stuff and talk to the radioman and look for subs. And it worked fine, and I never had to touch the stick.
What I hear is that with a couple of rubber bands, you created your own autopilot.
That's right. Never told anybody because it was my idea. Didn't want to make any big thing of it, and couldn't get a patent on it.
Well, you never know. I'm sure rubber bands have been redefined as many things over the years. It occurs to me that in flying these, I don't want to be insulting, but rinky-dink aircraft that are a far cry from what you've flown since then.
Crap crate.
That sounds like an apt description as well. You must have had some close calls and some moments where you thought, you know what, this might be it for me. Do you recall any of those?
In my 40 years?
Well, I'm sure you had a lot in 40 years, but in World War II specifically, did you have some moments where you thought, this is it right here?
Yeah, and that plane gave me those thoughts.
The plane that couldn't fly?
Yes, because the first guy that came and took off, the engine quit, and he went right into a village right near in Jamaica Bay, and it killed him. Those things are all new to me, and I wasn't used to an airplane not performing like an airplane.
Do you feel, when you look back at that, and the fact that you're one of the few guys that flew that plane in particular and a few of these planes, that you kind of paved the way for what would come later on? Because throughout the war, all these planes are being tinkered with. Famously, the P-38 originally had two props turning in the same direction, which didn't work very well. But it was guys like you who had to fly them that created the opportunity for those changes to be made. Do you feel like you gave something to aviation in that regard by flying planes that would have to be scrapped and learning the hard way that they didn't work that way?
Well, I think all of my pilots in this aviation division should participate in this heroic accolade that we're getting about airplanes. Now, this particular thing was such a mess to fly when you're trying to come in to do a precision landing near a buoy or land near a ship, and it had what they call slats on the leading edge of the wing. Am I getting too technical? Okay, these things are now used on the jets and other planes, and when you get down below, say, 110 knots, these slats come out about 3 or 4 inches, and that changes the aerodynamic form, you know, airflow over the wing. And you can fly supposedly more safely at slower speeds. It'll take you down to 80 knots before you stall and hit the water. And we needed that slowing down because that's the way the older planes were. You'd be flying, especially in formation. One of the slats would go out. I'm sorry, I'm flying the airplane there. So it would put you into a yaw, and you're only 20 feet away from this airplane you're flying on. And you got to avoid the midair collision. And the paperwork in around a midair collision just goes on forever, so there's no end to that. I've had some thoughts like that, and as I say, I didn't fly long enough to really wreck too many more, but between the six of us, we wrecked 16 of them. And I think that got the Admiral Halsey's attention, and he made him quit making them.
So six pilots went through 16 of those planes. None of the planes could make it.
No, because they get a saltwater immersion. If it's nothing more than this one tip float that lets it get into the salt water, all the instruments and the engine, you just have to rebuild the airplane practically. And that takes forever, and these shops weren't ready for that, and it was faster for them to make more airplanes. You send them to the Russians and the British, and they enjoyed it. They say, oh, whatever they say in Russian about, man, that was a beautiful flamer, you know, whatever.
Wow, what a comedy of errors. And you know, you mentioned Admiral Halsey, and certainly he's one of the personalities from World War II that people have talked about, the famous nickname Bull. You had some personal interactions with him. What was your impression of him?
Yeah. I met him one time at a party in Altoona, Pennsylvania after the war, because I was in the reserve, and I'd be flying at Anacostia, Washington, D.C. And we fly congressmen once in a while, and Navy was very smart in having a strong reserve. They were all for these congressmen who were pilots, and they wanted to encourage them to know more about the Navy. Here was a big thing in Altoona, and I was flying this congressman, I forget his name for the moment, but at this party, everybody was celebrating the tricentennial or something like that, 300th year, I don't know how many years. Here's Admiral Halsey at the one end of the bar with his elbow on it by himself, and I'm standing about 30 feet away, and I'm getting ready to order a drink, which I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to get an alcoholic drink because I got to fly back at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I had a twin-engine airplane. So I ordered a Coke, and I'm getting ready to pick up the Coke, and I saw Halsey looking at my drink, you know, and he knew who I was, you know, flying the congressman. And so I thought, I better get over there and talk to this guy about what I got, you know. And I think he had a scotch or something. He was a pretty jolly guy, and he was a good drinker, too, because he had to put up with a lot of crazy pilots that sometimes drink.
Were you guys ever intimidated by him or his reputation?
No. In fact, he could be intimidating. I recall the island of Vanikoro, north of the Guadalcanal toward Truk, where the Japs were based. So we were operating in those seas all up and down there. Our cruisers would go forward at almost flank speed, about almost 30 knots at night. The whole task force would go up there looking for a night battle. And we got into several. We'd come back during the daytime. We'd see this island of Vanikoro at the end of our scouting sector. This island, we didn't know whether it was Japanese held or not. And so one of my buddies on my ship, who lives now down in Monterey, he was out on a patrol 3 hours. He came back to where our task force was supposed to be. And they had changed course an hour before he came back. And we had equatorial fronts, which are hurricanes at sea. So in the middle of this squall, this hurricane, he couldn't see hardly anything, and he was flying at about 300 feet, and he could barely see the white caps, you know, the water. And so he thought, man, if there's any ships in here, I don't think I'll find them. He was running low on gas, and he remembered way back there at the end of his mission, where he turned to come in, he remembered seeing this island. So he told his radio, and he said, I don't know if it's Jap held or not, but let's go back there, and it's our chance. He came up on the island. And, of course, everything's supposed to be radio. You can't even report emergencies. Like, I sighted two combat ships one time, and I didn't dare call on the radio. However, he went back to the island, and he saw this ship that's about 200 feet long, and it was a patrol ship, you know, for working around close harbors. And it was converted to a tender for PBYs. And he came in and landed with nothing more than just a blinker signal. We used to use blinkers a lot. So he landed and went up to the ship, and they said, what the hell are you doing here? He says, well, my task force ran off and left me. And he says, oh, your task force 58. Yeah, I know about that. And let me show you where they are, or where they were, and where they are now. well, how come you know? And I'm a pilot on the ship, and they don't tell me when I'm flying in that area. Well, he says, that's the Navy, and he still didn't want us there. They wanted to get rid of us, so he gassed his plane up, fed him, and sent him out. And 3 hours after Bob was supposed to be out of fuel, here he is putzing around in the circle, you know, and we're in the middle of running the mess cooks up on the 20-millimeter cannon, you know, running some gun drills, you know, and we didn't want him to interfere. They didn't want to stop the ship with the task group that they were with, but they finally did. Anyway, he got back aboard, but it shows that this obedience to things that were written 30 years ago, say fleet doctrine, they're still nose into the book, and that's the way it's going to be no matter what the Japs are doing or what we can't do or can do. So it was a difficult thing to transition into the realm of airplanes.
And was there a Halsey connection to that story, too, that you were going to relate?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Halsey was at this island to set up the base originally. I got the story. And he was talking to, some of them were cannibals up in the hills. And it was also a penal colony for some of the Melanesians of other islands. They'd send them up to this place. And here's this chief on the island. He's talking to the Navy chief. And the Navy chief thought he could say, well, I'm a chief, you know, and I'm a big shot. And we want to bring a base in here. And the chief could talk a little bit of English. So the chief decided to bring in Halsey. Halsey was in the area. So Admiral Halsey came in, and he went to shore, and he talked to this chief. And the chief was, you know, saying, hey, no, 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 you can't do, and blah, 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 you can't come in. And he wasn't asking for, you know, something to, you know, to be given to him. So Halsey noticed on the chief he had something like a tattoo on his arm. Halsey said, that is beautiful. Where did you get that? He said, oh, I was working on a cargo ship, and back about 10 years ago, San Francisco. So he was having a great liberty at San Francisco, and he was showing it to everybody. Halsey said, well, I'll be darned. And he started rolling up his sleeve. We wore long sleeves all the time because of mosquitoes and sunburn. So he rolled up his sleeve, and he had a big anchor on there, and he showed that to the chief. Chief says, ooh, you chief? Yeah, I'm chief. Anchor. Chief, me chief. You tatted, you chief. Yeah, okay, fine. When do you want to bring the boat in, you know? And, of course, Halsey brought in all kinds of food, things like sugar and coffee and flour. They're big things to trade with out there. That opened it up, and Halsey still got his tattoo in the grave, I guess.
But he's not around to tell us that story, so I'm glad that you are. 91-year-old Dave Bowman, our guest today, and we're not done yet. More stories from Dave when we come back. And we'll also hear a little bit of what it's like to live at the California Veterans Home in Yountville. Fresno is getting one soon. This veterans home's been around since 1884, a little longer than Dave has. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this on News Talk 580 KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue with Dave Bowman, 91 years old. Go to kmjnow.com to see what he looks like, get a look at that infamous plane that wouldn't fly, and learn a little more about where he lives now, the beautiful California Veterans Home in Yountville, a great place to live if you meet the requirements, and definitely worth a visit if you make it up to wine country. I'm sure there are a million stories you could tell us about aviation and all the planes that you flew. In all that time where you're flying scouting missions and you're flying planes that are designed not necessarily to attack the enemy, but to observe the enemy. Did you ever wish you were flying one of those fighter planes, that you were dogfighting the Japanese?
I had put in for fighters initially from my start into Navy. And about halfway through my training, they give you a designation of, they say, what do you want to pursue later? What do you want to go into? And I said, I think fighters are the way to go. They get the most publicity and so forth. Oh, my big head. So I'm halfway into my formation squadron, and I got another month to go. And a buddy of mine who had gone into seaplanes, battleships, you know, battleships and cruisers, he says, damn it, Dave, I wanted fighters in the worst way, and I got battleships and cruisers. And I said, well, I wanted fighters, but I found out a classmate of mine from University of Maryland had gotten into the seaplane scouts, and he told me it's the best way to get to know the Navy, and if you're going, you go to the fork in the road where you're going to stay in the Navy, it'd be darn good to have that punched in your ticket. I took the seaplane and gave him the fighters, and I came back from overseas December of 44, and here was a big battle that went on, the Battle of the Coral Sea, I think it was, and here's this fighter group, the squadron. Life magazine is doing a feature article on them. They're on the first page, and there's about five pages inside. And here's a guy named Bill Martin, the guy that took my fighters. And they're showing a big picture of him with his family at the fireside and all that, his home. He shot down 8 zeros. Not that I could have, but maybe better him than me.
So he wouldn't have been an ace without you, giving him the spot.
Well, I could have been a half ace. But never mind, that's getting off the subject. I don't envy him, but on the other hand, it could have been me.
Well, when you say you could have been a half ace, are you telling me you shot down some planes?
No, but, you know, people don't understand this, but they say, well, didn't you see any action? Yes, I think there were about 3 or 4 times when I was not shot down by my own people. Cruisers were shooting at you, no radio control, you know, no radio communication. So they're very loosey-goosey. And they couldn't care less. You're just a round of ammunition. After all, that's what shot you off the catapult.
Exactly. And you mentioned you came home in December of 44. Now, I believe, and you've also talked about Halsey and Task Force 58. And I believe it was in December that Task Force 58 was caught in what was known as Halsey's Typhoon or Typhoon Cobra, where several ships actually sank with a large loss of life. Did you get out just ahead of that?
Yes. However, there were 2 cruisers sunk in night battles while I was aboard the cruiser Columbia, because we were not able to fly. We were not rigged, didn't have the equipment to fly at night, and we were very close to Guadalcanal. But the Japanese would come down the slot, we called it, and they would come in to bombard Guadalcanal and to look for our ships. And now we got our own task forces we're building up, and they clobbered one ship. Well, this one of the battles I'm talking about was Savo Island, where the Minneapolis had the bow blown off. We were there in the same battle. That's when they had these coconut logs across the bow, and we got their airplanes from that battle. Right. So we were close to the battles, but these night battles we had at sea, the Japanese Bettys would come in on us from New Georgia Island. And they would be 10 or 15 of them, and they'd come in about dusk. They would come in with their lights off, and they'd come down to about 30 or 40 feet because they could see the wake. The wake will glow a little bit from the phosphorus in the water. They could track sometimes the task force. They didn't have radar either. But they'd start a run on us, and they would try to attract us to shoot tracer bullets at them. Now they really know where we are. So they would go back and forth and back and forth, and when we'd stop shooting, we'd lose sight of them, not sight of them, but we didn't know where they were. We'd shoot at each other's tracers that were shooting out there. So we would stop shooting, and they would wonder where we were, so they'd turn on their navigation lights. Now here comes 2 of them abreast running on our ship, and we were shot at a number of times. We didn't get hit with torpedoes. And my job as an aviator on the ship at that time was to be either in the radio shack, which was a compartment that was everything was shut down on the ship, the fan, the circulation, the air conditioning, and the humidity and the heat would just boil up even in the nighttime. So we'd be in there decoding messages, and the pilots would. And also, one of the guys decoding with us was Robert Montgomery, who was a very famous, he was a lieutenant in the Navy. He's a PT boatman. He joined our ship at Guadalcanal. He lost his PT boat.
This is Robert Montgomery, the Hollywood actor nominated a couple times for Academy Awards for movies like Here Comes Mr. Jordan.
He had had his 88th air raid aboard our ship because he had gone back to 1937 in a Spanish revolution, Spanish Revolution, I think it was, over in Europe, and he was driving ambulances. Movie guy. What a modest, wonderful person. So it was, he was a good teammate of mine, and he would relieve me when I was, you know, decoding or whatever, or officer of the deck or something like that. I forget where I was, and I'm running out of gas.
Well, we're running short on time, but when you got home from the war, when you think back on the time you spent in the Navy now, what are you most amazed by? What are you most thankful for?
Well, I retired from the Navy 21 years, became a professional. I continued as a professional pilot for a total of 40 years. I was so glad to have all my components and parts and everything. I was so grateful that at least 30 times I should not be here, I figure.
30 times that you should not have survived?
I think so. And there were times when I didn't know who was aiming at me, so I don't know, you know, when I could have had it. So I can't complain. I thank the God for sending me to Georgetown University and getting a good Christian education that with a Jesuit priest, and that's still serving me well.
Well, I went to Syracuse, but I'll forgive you for going to Georgetown, our biggest rival when I was there, at least on the basketball court. 184 different models of airplane. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, it was the top of the line for the Cessna twin-engine aircraft, a pressurized high-speed airplane, high-altitude airplane. And I was in charge of accessories at Cessna Aircraft when it was coming off the line. I was working for them for 19 years. I'd demonstrate airplanes a lot. So I would take that airplane, and I'd go all over the country with it and have dealers and distributors line up customers, and I'd go in and spend, you know, 2-3 days at one airport just to get their prospects in the air. And we sold a lot of airplanes that way.
I expected to hear P-38, P-51, F-4U, something like that, but a Cessna takes the cake, huh?
Well, yeah, among all planes, but among Navy planes, I like the old SBD dive bomber. I flew that for many years, and that was a very good airplane, well-made. And another plane was an amphibian, a J-2F, which is an old fabric biplane that was used for utility, for air-sea rescue, and for utility to haul six people total. We did a lot of work with that airplane.
When's the last time you flew?
1980. I flew with a Beechcraft dealer then, and we were selling that type of aircraft. And I was getting old enough that I didn't care, and I was going to go out and sell commercial real estate.
So you don't miss it?
Yeah, I miss it, but I've kept my head down and kept busy. And I've been 36 years with the Barbershop Singers, and I'm out with them every, you know, one night every week and sing for 3 hours, shows and competitions and concerts.
You ever sing in the cockpit?
Yeah, I do, and I rattle a lot of rosary beads. I've worn them out flying in the airplane, and that may be the thing that got me here.
Amen. We're out of time, but in closing, is there anything else you want to share with our audience, people that weren't alive in World War II that you think people ought to know about that time in our history?
Yes, get your application in. I wish I'd have committed myself sooner, say a year or so sooner, to take advantage of all these wonderful picnics and parties and everything that's going on amongst these wonderful people. They just treat us perfectly. The federal government, through the Veterans Affairs, sanctions us, and the state of California, they also sponsor us. We have a very comfortable arrangement with our support here, and we are contributing to it. So we feel like we're doing something worthwhile.
So you think veterans should apply to live here at the Veterans Home? You wish you would have done it earlier.
Yes, two of my neighbors have done it, and we're glad to have them here.
Is one of the perks of living at the California Veterans Home a chance to hear you sing?
Yes, now we have our own octet. We have 8 singers just among the people on the campus here. And we'll be able to do a lot of in-house. We haven't even announced ourselves yet, but we have 8,000 chapters in the United States of this organization. I came from Santa Rosa, so I joined the Napa chapter, and they're halfway into town. So I go there for Tuesday nights and sing with them. That's fun. It's a way of life.
And I guess 91 is not too old to keep singing, huh?
No, indeed. My voice is still there, and I just learned how to treat it, and it helps me a lot.
Did you want to sing something for us?
I'll sing to Jody. Let me call you, sweetheart. I'm in love with you. Let me hear you whisper. Am I taking too much time?
It sounds good to me. I don't know about Jody if she's blushing over there.
That you love me too. Keep the love light glowing in your eyes so blue. Let me call you, sweetheart. I'm in love with you.
Boy, how many women have swooned over that song in all the years since you first sung it a long time ago? Dave Bowman, 91 years old, a resident at the California Veterans Home in Yountville. Thank you for serving our country and for the singing performance, too.
You going to print that singing?
You want me to?
Sure, I don't care. Recruit more singers.
All right. Big thanks to Jody Price from the California Veterans Home in Yountville for connecting us with Dave Bowman today. Also, Bob Heiss, who you heard from last week. We look forward to the Veterans Home in Fresno as well, and we'll look forward to another edition of Hometown Heroes. Next time, first in the nearly 200 episodes of this program on KMJ, you'll hear from a winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor. He earned it with the Go for Broke Soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.